Well, hi, everyone. I'm Beattie Cohen-Fratos, and welcome again, my friends, to the Ask Beattie Show. And for those of you who may be tuning in for the very first time, I mean, even though I have been hosting the Ask Beattie Show here on the Progressive Radio Network, it is going on to 9 years. It's like, where has the time gone? But I am a psychotherapist. I'm also a sex therapist. I'm the author of the groundbreaking book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. I'm also the advice columnist to Dan's Papers in the Hamptons, a national speaker, national radio and television expert guest. And I'd say probably one of my greatest passions, other than my husband, Jim, is my private practice. And I have a private practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton. So what is the Ask Beattie Show really all about? Well, the fact is that we all go through so many ups and downs in our life, and none of us is immune from life's challenges. So on this show, we talk about mental health issues and sexuality and relationships. And more importantly, we talk about how and what to do, not just to think, not just to dream, but the things that we can actually do to maximize our physical, our emotional, our sexual well-being, despite the stressors of life. And I have a mantra, and I want to share my mantra with you, and that is to be willing to be serious, to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we can, even though we all know we cannot change history, the things that get in the way of our lives and of our relationships. And one of the things, I mean, I hope I've convinced you of a lot of things over the years, but I really do hope that I have convinced you that we don't need to take this journey on our own. It is way, way too difficult. So that reaching out to family, I mean, hopefully you have loving, supportive, functional family and friends. And if need be, professionals can make and do make our life journey easier and life isolated and alienated and lonely. Because I mean, the reality is that we are struggling. I mean, for example, if we're looking at the clinical depression rates, we're looking at 17 million adults, and I've been citing the statistic, hoping that the statistic may be going down a little bit, but 17 million adults in the United States suffer from depression. Females seem to experience, or at least we express our depression at roughly two times the rate for men. 80 to 90%, and I think this is good news for those seeking treatment for depression and also anxiety, can be treated successfully. So that if you're finding that you are going around in circles, and you've tried exercise and you've tried meditation and vitamins, and you're still finding that the depression and the anxiety are pretty much taking over your life, I hope, I really do hope that you will give yourself permission and reach out and ask for help. Well, I have a guest today, and I'm really excited about meeting Dr. Elizabeth Gordon. We haven't met in person. Welcome, Dr. Gordon. Really
thank you.
Here we are on Zoom. We can actually look at each other. And Dr. Gordon is a board-certified psychiatrist who specializes in sexual health. She has an integrative approach, which is exactly the reason why I wanted you to come on the show. She is a thought leader, an innovative speaker, educator, researcher, and writer dedicated to advancing sexual health in both public and academic forums. She maintains a private practice here in very, very beautiful. It's 75 degrees here in New York City today. And in her work, Dr. Gordon brings a passion for destigmatizing, and we've continued to need to do that, and improving sexual health, and strives to increase the understanding of how sexual health is bidirectionally correlated with all health, from psychological, physical, through socioeconomic. Well, I'm just so happy to see you. And meet each other here on the video. So I'm very, very curious. When you first started off, after you did all of your training, did you think that you were going to be focusing on and specializing in the world of sexual health?
You know, not right when I finished my medical training. In retrospect, my path pointed me there from early on, but there was a bit of a pause at the end of my medical training and the end of my residency when I was more focused on integrative and complementary medicine and psychiatry. And I think that that is largely due to the fact that sexual health is not taught very well in health education in general. And certainly within medical education, there was a bit of a peak in the 1970s and then some continued sexual health education. But by the 2000s, it started to fall off, and it's been consistently falling off since. And one of the things I do now is a lot of advocacy work to get more sexual health education back in medical education and other health education, and do a lot of mentoring of people who are interested in following the path. So it wasn't something I thought of immediately, but then as I looked around and thought about it, I did find some programs. I had done lots of reading on my own, had some training in it, and thought pursuing more training would be actually where I wanted to go with it.
Well, you know, it's so interesting because after I did my training at McGill, I did my postgraduate specialization in marriage and family therapy and also sexual dysfunction. So I had a 3-year program at the Jewish General Hospital in Montreal. And we were very upbeat in those days, hoping that there was going to be some really positive impact on people's beliefs and on their actual, you know, sexual lives. And yet what I'm finding in my practice now, and I was saying to a friend this morning, even though I'm also a sex therapist, nobody ever really calls. I'd say less than 1% of people call with the presenting problem being, you know, sexual kinds of issues. And yet, you know, what I am finding, and this is with young and old and middle-aged, is that we're really not doing well in the bedroom, despite the fact we seem to be living, you know, at least I think it's an illusion in this very sexualized world, at least here in the United States. So I'm so curious, who are your patients, and do they contact you primarily because of, in quotes, sexual issues?
Yes. My practice is all sexual health all the time. It is known as that. I've put it out as that. It is known as that through the variety of healthcare practitioners that I work with. So I get lots of referrals for it. But people also find me on the internet. I have a website. There was recently an article in the New York Times I was quoted in. People have been finding me through that. And who are they? They range. I do not see children, but I do quite a bit of work supporting pediatric sexual health, either doing consults with parents to help support or giving talks about the need to support it. And I see everybody, personally see and treat everybody from age 18 on up. So my patients, the youngest has been 18, the oldest was 83 when we started. And they range in gender definition, they range in orientation, they range in sexual preferences or proclivities. I see people as they come for a variety of sexual health issues, which can either be individual problems with desire or libido, problems with arousal, problems with orgasm, or problems with pain with sex. But I also see people who are having problems with sex as part of their relationship, whether that's discrepancy of desire or People have different interests and how to mesh them. And I will meet people where they're at. So traditionally, the sex therapy approach way back in the 1950s, when it was conceptualized, as you know, was to see a married heterosexual couple for a intense treatment over the course of a number of weeks. But I do not work that way. I will see anybody who wants to come. If they are in a relationship, I do recommend that they bring their partner or partners into the treatment with them, because sexuality does not happen in a vacuum. So we can get a lot farther, a lot faster if all the partners are involved. But if they are not comfortable with that, then I will meet them where they're at and we work individually, either first or for the whole time. So it is a broad variety. And I see people who are questioning their gender. I see people who are questioning their orientation, who are feeling hesitant about what their interests are or worried about their interests or the level of their interests, as well as treating some of the fundamental sexual dysfunctions.
I think it's a terrific thing that people are questioning, you know, all of the above, and that, you know, what's going on in the media right now. I think that we're in many ways really giving people permission that we never did 20 years ago, 30 years ago, to be questioning all these very different things in terms of, you know, sexual orientation, you know, whether or not we want to have an open relationship. And so all of these things, you know, fortunately, are now being talked about. And yet what I'm seeing in my practice, I see a number of 25, 30-year-old women, MBA, Harvard, Yale types. And the number one thing that I am finding, number one, and these are brilliant, gorgeous, lovely, educated, you know, they're on this path, at least, you know, professionally. Number one, they don't know their own bodies. They absolutely do not. And when we talk about it, you know, I'll say to them, well, have you told your partner, now that you're masturbating, now that you're becoming familiar a little bit, you know, with what feels good and what doesn't feel good, are you communicating this to your partner? Well, the answer almost all the time is absolutely not. You know, I'm not comfortable. And when I have, the response hasn't been all that great and supportive. Now, are you finding this also with patients that you're seeing?
Yes, and I think that it's not only do we have a significant amount of stigma around sexuality in general, but then we've defined sexuality, or implicitly we teach that sexuality is something to be engaged with other people.
Right.
Rather than providing the scientifically supported, research supported, sex positive sex ed that begins with the premise that sexuality is innate to the human being, that sexuality is an innate component of your health, just like your physical health, just like your mental health, that you have a component of sexuality that also needs attending to. And so I often work with people on their own or within partnered relationships, and we work on trying to understand that owning your own pleasure, knowing your own pleasure, through some forms of self-exploration and through forms of the sensate focus, which is the baseline treatment, as you know, but maybe the listeners don't. It's a form of exploring the senses and the sensations to be able to better focus on them, not just the sexual ones, but all sensations. And really getting them to understand that sexuality is theirs, that they need to understand and be able to incorporate their own pleasure to be better able to communicate it and better able to understand what they like, and that that is actually sexy in the long run. Right. It is more sexy than just being focused on trying to please your partner or hoping your partner is going to get it right.
Right. And I think that's one of the things, too, is that, A, you know, we need to, as you say, own and be very in tune with our own sexuality. And then, you know, hopefully, if we choose to be with a partner who is open about hearing about our needs. I mean, our emotional needs, our sexual needs, you know, our other needs across the board. And if, and that's, I'll say to people all the time, if you have partners and if you're with people who are saying, no, 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 your needs are not important. I mean, this is certainly a big red flag, you know, not just about sex. I mean, who wants to be in a relationship with somebody who is invalidating our needs, our wants, sexual, emotional, psychological? Yet, as I said, I find, and, you know, I grew up, and Canada is certainly, I think, a much more liberal country when it comes to sexuality. Not perfect. We're still not doing a great job in terms of, you know, sex ed. We're still talking, you know, really just physiological, you know, in a way, in so many of the course material in the schools, if the kids are lucky enough to actually be getting any sex ed, you know, really at all. But there's still, you know, I still find this tremendous resistance in giving ourselves permission to own our bodies and own our sexuality and be willing to ask for what we want if we are indeed going to be with somebody or some bodies.
And I think that some of that is the flip side of the coin of being told that your sexuality only can be valid in the context of engaging with others. That the flip side of that coin becomes that if your partner wants to engage with themselves, that means that you are not doing something right to support what you've been taught is the context of sexuality, that you are not doing something right to support the partnered engagement, and that we really need to work backwards and start to understand that the sometimes that negative answer from a partner, oh, no, 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 I can't believe that you're engaging in sex on your own, or you want to masturbate, the premise of that is, what am I doing that's not enough? How right. am I not enough? What am I doing wrong? Right. Without being able to understand that somebody who can do what they want to do and knows their own pleasure, and that self-pleasure is a separate entity. It's not just a corollary to partnered activity. It's a separate entity. That sometimes that is enough. That is what the person wants. And it's not because you are not enough. It's because that's what they want. We would never be with a partner right. who couldn't feed themselves, right? Oh, no, no, I'm starving, but I'm waiting for you to be home so that I can eat, always. Right. And if you're not home, then I can't eat. Then we would think that that was crazy, but that's because we're taught that you must attend to certain basic needs. And sometimes, yes, you can wait a little bit longer to enjoy eating a meal with your partner, but sometimes if you're really starving, you need to eat a little snack at least to get there, or you should just sit down and eat. But if we were taught that sexuality was very similar, that right. this is something that you own, you need to take care of, and you can enhance that and make it even better when you engage with somebody else at times, but sometimes it's perfectly good on your own or great on your own, then it would be a different conversation.
But it's not just better, or maybe even better on your own.
You know? Yes, sometimes it can be. Exactly. Sometimes people just want a little bit of pleasure without having to think about anything else, do anything else. And it's just, I just want a quick bit of pleasure.
Exactly. And you know, it's funny, I was in Sarasota, Florida a week ago, and I was talking with a woman, and we were talking about sex toys. Interesting. I'd actually just met her, and I told her what I did, and she, you know, brought up the subject of sex toys, and she was saying, I have a good marriage, but, you know, these days, I don't want to have to think about him. I don't want to have to think about his pleasure. I just want to be able, I want to have an orgasm. I want to have an orgasm, and I have, you know, a drawer full, you know, full of sex toys that I enjoy. And, you know, so she was saying that, you know, it's at least at this point, engaging with her husband felt like work, and she wasn't interested in doing any work right now in the world of sex. I mean, I don't know what was going on, of course, in the relationship or marriage, and we were just having sort of a girl talk. But it was interesting because, and you know what, I was looking at some of the sex toy revenue. A few years ago, I was actually a spokesperson for a couple of sex toy manufacturing companies. So, and people may be really surprised to hear this, that the global sex toy market is projected to reach $64.6 billion by 2026.
Yeah.
So, Right.
Sex toys are, a great way to expand your repertoire, to have fun with yourself, with your partner. It was just recently National Sex Toy Day. And the reality is that people use them and like them. And sex toys have been around for a very, 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 very long time.
Right. And I think, as you say, I mean, whatever it is that turns you on with or without a partner, it is about giving yourself permission to do what is, you know, I talk about what is in your best interest across the board, whether we're talking about financially or relationship-wise or sex-wise. You know, and I wonder, too, what you think about, you know, the whole porn site, Pornhub. I was looking at these numbers as well. 28.5 billion visits to Pornhub, translating into 1,000 visits a second, 78.1 million visits a day. And I wonder, you know, how much the pandemic, you know, there was so much isolation and less socialization, actually, you know, contributed to these numbers. I mean, you know, 78.1 million people a day are on Pornhub, and what your thoughts are about porn. What are your thoughts about porn?
I think that porn is something that is almost universally fascinating, because again, I think that sexuality is innate to being human. And many animals like to watch their own species and sometimes even other species having sex.
There's
the famous case of the little panda in the zoo that was in no way interested in having sex, not having learned about it until they showed him panda porn. And then he was very excited about it. And I think that it's a bit of a, it's a huge topic, but it's also a bit of a complicated topic. So I do, as part of the advocacy work that I do in the teaching, I advocate for porn literacy. So I would like to start with what that is. It's sort of understanding what porn is and what porn isn't. And I think that it's important to get this to kids before they see porn. So I want everybody, particularly kids who are going to now be exposed to porn, to understand what pornography is. Pornography is mostly a stylized version of sexual engagement that is not focused on relationships as much, that has stylized gender roles quite often, and that is a number of stylized situations, and it comes with editing, it comes with special effects, it's meant for engaging with or consuming it as a form of entertainment. It is not real life sex. And that is the most important message to get across to kids or to a number of other people who are watching this who don't understand that this is not the reality, that real sex can be messy, can be funny, can be tender, can be even better than pornography, can involve discussion, can involve relationship, can involve communication, and all the other components, such as safety, safe sex measures, et cetera, et cetera. But that would be the starting point. And then if we look at where porn is consumed most, it's not only is it consumed when we were in lockdown, which kind of makes sense. Everybody's bored out of their minds. The only way to do anything is on the computer. But where porn is consumed the most is where there are more strict sexual stigmas. So where there are more stringent sexual stigmas. So the states in the United States that tend to skew more red and that have populations that have more to say against open sexual engagement tend to watch a lot more pornography consistently. And that is true around the world too, that the countries in which sexuality is more stigmatized and more shut away, not talked about, and kept behind closed doors, the amount of porn that is consumed in those countries tends to be much, much higher. And there's a lot of arguments about whether porn can become an addiction or not, whether it can become problematic. And here is my personal take, informed by the science behind it, that no, you do not necessarily have porn addiction. You cannot become physically addicted to this. You may feel some psychological tug to do so, but it's not the same as an addiction. It is usually, almost always, I have not yet seen a case in which it hasn't been, a way to avoid engaging with something else that is distressing. So it's a way to avoid anxiety, a way to avoid something else that's going on in your life, and instead to get sort of a mindless fix of some feel-good hormones and not have to focus on what's going on. But that being said, there's also that gray area in between, which is so many people that worry about their use of porn. The research really shows that the more guilt you feel over engaging with pornography, the more likely you are to be worried about your use of porn, and the more likely you are to think that you have that porn addiction. So that it's not really there's no line of, oh, if you consume X amount of hours, then the people who consume more than that are more likely to think they're addicted. It's more, how worried are you about your engagement with this medium that predicts whether or not you think you're addicted?
And I guess also how interested you are in engaging, and this isn't a judgment at all on my part, with real life people. You know, what is your preference? Is all of this porn, you know, about avoidance? Is it about fear? I see actually a number of young men, and it's so disturbing to me. They're lovely, they're nice, they're smart, they're in their late 20s. And what's happened, they've had some, you know, social kinds of issues, which is why they initially contacted me. And their best friends are the porn sites. So they have gotten very used to not going out. Of course, so many people are still on Zoom, and that's kind of become the, you know, the preferential way of meeting people and connecting with people. And I'm seeing that more and more as this sort of Zoom technology, you know, connection in quotes with people is really continuing. Now, are you seeing this in your practice where there has actually become a preference for sex toys, porn, rather than, you know, if there is an interest to go out one way or another and try and connect with a human being? I mean, there are even stories about the MEMS. There was something in the New York Times where people are having sex with fantasy characters on the internet.
Yeah, I think that the precipitous rise in this probably does have something to do with the lockdown. And particularly in a younger population, having 2 years of lost socialization time is a huge percentage of your growth time, your growth period. So that we're seeing it even with people who are older, that coming out of the lockdown, people are a little bit more anxious about their social interaction. So if you add in that you didn't have much chance to socialize beforehand as an adult or in a specific way, you haven't formulated your sense of self, your social self, your sexual self, and you add in that anxiety of reapproaching this, it can make you very anxious. And I would think that in those cases, it might be easier to avoid that social anxiety, to avoid the distress that being worried about it and being uncertain about how to interact with other people, and to avoid the potential rejection by interacting with something that can't reject you and that is purely pleasurable. But it becomes self-perpetuating at that point.
Right, right. And very lonely. I mean, you know, and that's what I'm hearing more and more. You know, we're not so comfortable going out and meeting. We're not having a lot of luck on the dating sites. We're young, we're horny. And at this point, our preference is definitely going to be porn or sex toys. And of course, that part of what I'm trying to do is get people to reach out and try to form some real life relationships with real life people, and that maybe that's going to be able to help enhance their lives sexually, emotionally, psychologically, you know, across the board. I know that many of my listeners would be very interested, for example, let's say the presenting problem. Let's make up a number. Let's say a woman a married woman in her 40s or 50s with a couple of young kids. So there's a lot of energy that's being put out with that. I have low libido or no sex drive at all, and they are coming to see Dr. Gordon to see what she can do to try and revive. Hopefully at one point this person had libido and had desire. What is your methodology? What do you do?
So I, having been trained as a medical doctor, take a bit of the medical approach first. So we have a bit of a triage in what we want to rule out. And the first thing I do is talk to them, try to understand what their story is, what they're seeking help with, so that would be sort of our chief complaint, then the history of the problem, when did it start, what went into it, the person coming to me or this woman coming to me can identify, can she think of anything, what else is going on around this complaint, and sort of understand where she would like to get to. Then with this, for this case, when you say a woman in her 40s or 50s, the first thing that comes to my mind is we have to be thinking about perimenopause or menopause, depending upon the age. So then we need to assess physically. Has she had a workup? Has she had a general checkup? I want to make sure that all of her bloods are okay, meaning her chemistry, her blood profile, et cetera. And I also want to know, is she in perimenopause? So I would take a careful history about her menstruation and also be asking and seeing if some of this lack of desire might be because there's pain in engaging or discomfort in engaging or dryness, and whether we are dealing with some of the genitourinary symptoms of menopause. And if so, then I want to send her to a gynecologist or a urogyn to be assessed and to consider treatment with some hormones or some other lubrication, or so that hormones would either be vaginal hormones, vaginal estrogen, or some other systemic hormones, depending on where she is and what her blood levels are. And if that is not the case, if everything is all good on that end, she's been completely worked up and we get to it, then we want to assess where is she in her relationship, where is she with her level of energy. So if this is okay, yeah, but I have 16 kids running around and I work a full-time job and I have no help at home and I have to get the dinner on the table for the 16 kids and me and my husband, plus get the 16 kids to the where are you fitting this in? Where do you expect to fit this in? How can we support you where you're at first and give you room and space? So we want to be looking at sort of holistic health. Are you getting enough sleep? Are you getting what you need? Are you getting what you need mentally to support you? And then also look at relational health. Is this a question of, well, I used to have libido, but my husband or wife has been having an affair with somebody else. And, now they've said they didn't want to come home. Well, we might want to examine how you feel about that and whether that's going into your reluctance to engage with your partner, for instance. Or maybe it's something else that's more subtle. So we want to look at the relational health as well and try to understand that. If all of the above are completely fine, everything's good, and it just is that this has died off for absolutely no reason, then we want to look at whether she is happy when she engages with herself. Does she feel okay about that engagement? Is she attending to her own pleasure? How much pleasure was she getting out of engagement before this fell off? And what could we do to return some of that pleasure and get her back there? So then we would really focus more on the individual or the relational components of that engagement. So it's sort of a multi-pronged process of making sure the physical health is okay, the psychological health, the relational health, and looking at how we can support the sexual health throughout all of those, but also with all of those.
Well, of course, I love the in-depthness of everything, that you're saying. And I want to tell you a really interesting story. And this was a friend of mine. Miserable marriage for over 35 years, zero sexual desire, certainly with her husband, there were no affairs. She saw just a multitude of doctors who put her on every conceivable kind of, you know, HRT, the hormone replacement, and found in the lab work that there were a lot of things that weren't quite optimal for where she was in terms of her age and stage in life. And she was really, you know, concerned. She wasn't very Christian, was told that it was not okay to masturbate, even though she's a very sort of liberal kind of woman in a lot of ways. Anyways, long story short, she meets a guy online. And, you know, for somebody who's very religious, this is something that, I mean, talk about going out of her comfort zone. I was talking to her very, very recently. She said that she has never, ever in her, and this is all done on the internet. I mean, they've never met. That's right. That was a man that she had never met in person. He was in another country. And she was saying that her libido has never been what it is today. And she's now in her mid-50s. No longer need for hormone replacement, all the creams, all the lubrication, all the testing. And she discovered her sexuality at age 55. And I think it's a wonderful story that she freed herself sufficiently. And I'm certainly not advocating that people have extramarital affairs and go online if they're in committed relationships. And the marriage, it was not happening. I mean, they had tried therapy, and it would have probably been better for this couple years ago to have actually gone their separate ways. But that is not going to happen. So this relationship is ongoing. But the thing that has really surprised her is with all of the medical intervention over the years, and there was a lot, that it was all really pretty useless. But the fact was is that there had never been the chemistry with her husband, and that with this particular man, there's chemistry, there's intellectual and emotional compatibility, and she is at, I think, the highest level ever of her own sexuality at age 55.
I think that that's also, there's a couple of other things that I'm hearing that I think are important to highlight for the listeners, which is, one, women often come into their sexuality later, because a large part of the reason for that is that there's more stigma around sexuality for women. And that the 40s and 50s are a time when women often feel done with the strictures of being young, feel done with the strictures of being mother, and finally have some room, sometimes around perimenopause, sometimes it's just because finally having some room with the kids out of the house to be themselves and to come into their own. That is part of the time where it seems like that might have been part of what went into it, or it needs to be explored. But the other component of that too is that it's very important to note that despite our cultural story that men are the ones who want sex and women want emotional connection, there is a significant body of research that is showing that is not the reality, or that is certainly not the breadth and depth of the reality, that the research is showing that both sexes, or anybody who identifies as non-binary, anywhere along that spectrum, are interested in sex, and that also anybody along that spectrum is interested in some form of emotional connection, but maybe not at the same time. And there's some fascinating research in two areas. One is that it seems that within the context of committed long-term relationships, it is actually men's libido will diminish slowly and steadily over time over the course of about 10 years. But that for women, it actually kind of takes a nosedive after one. And yet, if you look at the other side of that, if you look at who is going to have affairs, who is going to engage in non-consensual non-monogamy or extra-dyadic coupling, that very often men are looking to have sexual affairs for an emotional connection, while women are looking to have sexual affairs for the sex.
Right.
And so that it's an interesting component, and I wonder how much of these also went into your friend's story.
Right. Well, she had been sexually and emotionally starved forever in this marriage. And, you know, she's been very lucky. And of course, she's been very fortunate that her husband has not found out. I mean, this is something, and this is a very close friend. And, you know, she's been lucky. I mean, these days, if somebody looks, anything can be found on the phones, everything can be found, you know, on the computers. And, you know, her religious upbringing, I mean, that's been something that has really kind of tormented her, you know, but not enough that she is willing to give up, you know, this relationship. And it's interesting. And I'm seeing, you know, other women in their 50s and 60s, and exactly what you're saying, with their husband's drive. And in quotes, performance, and I hate that word, but we know what we're talking about, has taken a bit of a dive where their sexual energy is at a peak that maybe they had not known, you know, previously in earlier years. But we need to talk about all this stuff, right?
Yes. And I think that what the most important way to counter the stigma, and we know again and again in so many forums, we know that stigma has negative health repercussions. Right. So the best way to counter the stigma is to educate and to normalize. And the best way to do that is keep talking.
Exactly. And your patients, they're open, obviously, to talking, or they would not be seeing you.
Right. Right. But, you know, therein lies the rub, because so often it's those that are not open to talking that need this information the most. So doing some advocacy in other ways is also part of my repertoire.
No, it sounds great. Now, do you see any men?
Or yes.
You do?
Yes. No, I see men, women, I see non-binary, I see however you identify, you can come and talk to me. And whatever sex, gender, however you feel about it, you can still come and talk to me. So I see all of the above. Yeah.
Now, with the men, what is your treatment of choice after ruling out physical issues with erectile dysfunction?
It depends on what, you know, it depends on the history. So erectile dysfunction can be tricky because there are so many physiological things that can go into it. We call the penis the canary in the coal mine. Right. The penis, and this is based on the fact that the arteries to the penis as an organ, not being the largest organ, no offense to anybody who owns a penis, but it is not the largest organ, say, compared to the heart or the brain. And so the arteries that go to it, just purely physiologically, the arteries that go to it are quite small. So if we look at the size of an artery and we look at a large artery, say, that goes to the heart, or we look at a small artery that goes to the penis, if you have the same amount of plaque buildup, that's going to be a considerably larger percentage of the area in the artery to the penis because it's smaller, as opposed to the percentage area of the artery to the heart. So things will register, whether it's nerve damage or blood vessel damage, will register in the penis before they register often in the rest of the body. So when we see erectile dysfunction, we need to be thinking about making sure there are no other causes, particularly the cardiovascular causes,
right,
and make sure that somebody is healthy. If that is all completely fine, if they are young, they are healthy, all of the plumbing, all of the electrics are working. By plumbing, I mean the vasculature, electrics, the nerves. Then they could try a course of PDE5 inhibitors. That's the Viagra, Cialis, et cetera, that people know. We call those the class of medications PDE5 inhibitors. But I will say that they don't necessarily have the best return.
Exactly. And I'm hearing this more and more from the men. And there's been so much, you know, right? There's been so much hype about the magic of the Viagra, the Cialis, the Levitra. Men that I see are saying, you know, some are saying, okay, but the majority are saying exactly what you are saying and what your experience is.
And what I think is going on is that we have undervalued the fact that the brain is the most important sexual organ of all time, and that the brain exerts its own effects. And even if everything is intact, very often, if there are other things going on or other anxieties, that can counter the PDE5 inhibitor effect. And so the rate of refill for these prescriptions is actually quite low. So I will usually let people know this and work with them. And if they want to try some or try some for a short time, but I also explain that with a course of sex therapy, we can not necessarily guarantee that you're going to have rock hard erections all the time from here on out. That is not the point, because the reality is that over the course of the lifetime, the return of or the return on attempting to get rock hard erections gets less and less.
Right.
But that we can go through and make sure that whoever is engaged in the therapy is learning ways and understanding themselves to have an increased satisfaction with their sex life, not only in the present, but ongoing, because they can learn ways and tips and tricks to make sure that they are having the kind of pleasure that they want in getting the satisfaction out of their sexual engagement that they want, no matter what is going on with the various body parts.
Right. Of course, testosterone levels are, you know, that's another component that, you know, is an issue. I mean, I remember years ago, I had a man who I was working with, and I said, look, what is your testosterone level? So he says to me, he says, my doctor says it's fine. I said, okay, it may be fine. I want another number. So he comes back and the number was 150. So that was a problem. And maybe for the doctor, because the man, I believe at the time he was in his 60s, maybe thought, well, maybe for a man who's 60 years old, he probably doesn't have a lot of sex, and maybe, you know, 150 isn't such an issue, and let me not upset, you know, this man's life with, you know, talking about testosterone levels. But it's important, right? I mean, men who are listening to this need to know that they do need to have their levels done, and a healthy range, in your estimation, because I hear different people saying different things all the time, would be what?
Ah, you know, it's harder for me to give the exact numbers. There is not consistent research across the board that correlates numbers with clinical presentation. So I don't want to throw out specific numbers. I think what is more important to understand is that, yes, testosterone diminishes with age, that there is not huge amounts of data that support specific numbers or specific ranges with specific function, behavioral function. And so that what's more important to understand is what is your general health status, and not necessarily pin it on testosterone, because it's not only testosterone. Yes, testosterone falls with age, but also the older you are, the more likely you are to have concomitant illnesses, the more likely you are to be on more medications, and medications are a huge problem for sexual side effects. And the more you mix medications, the more likely you are exponentially to have these sexual side effects. So I am hesitant to provide a single number, and I would be more interested in them, the men or testosterone owning people who have this issue, to consider going to somebody who is well-versed in sexual medicine or well-versed in sexual health to make sure that all of these different components are being considered. And because I do see too many people who are just put on testosterone because their number is low, quote unquote, but that's not actually, it's sort of that same thing, that hormone replacement therapy, or the idea of, throw you on a PDE5. Well, what else is going on? What else is going on? How do you feel about it? What else do you need? Because nothing comes without a price.
No, exactly. Have you found that there is a real correlation between obesity and erectile dysfunction?
I think that you can make a safe statement saying a little bit more globally, to the extent that obesity is related to other health conditions, right, that again, you will have impact on erectile dysfunction. One of the things that I say very commonly to my medical students, not necessarily about obesity, but I say, you know, it's really important to remember all of these sexual conditions with all of these other illnesses, because people, not only is it important to protect sexual health, but you can use this as a very important motivator. So when you're saying to somebody, oh, you know, your cholesterol's high or your blood sugar's high, and this really could cause some impairment down the line with your vision, or in 10 years, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be at risk for a heart attack. That doesn't have the same impact as, hey, your cholesterol's high or your sugar's high, and in 2 years, you could have problems having an orgasm.
Right.
That hits people. Now they want to change something about it. So that I think, it's understanding that it's not necessarily a specific, you know, a global specific condition. It's what underneath is going on. So if you're carrying weight and you are doing everything and you're healthy, then that probably is not going to be the issue. But if you, even if you're thin and you're only eating sugar all the time and you consistently have high blood sugar, then that's going to be an issue. Uh-huh. It's the underlying component. So it's really being clear about what components are going into each of these issues.
You know, the thing I love about your integrative approach is that it's an integrative approach. And, you know, so often men will go to their urologist, and it's probably, if they're lucky, a 15-minute, if that, you know, discussion. And then they will leave with a prescription, right, of Viagra, Cialis, Levitra, and at times the pump. Have you had success with men who've used the pump in order to be able to get and maintain erections? Do you use
the external pump?
Yeah.
External pump?
Yes,
I think that an external pump along with a cock ring can do wonders for people who have some limitations to the vasculature of the penis.
Right.
It can help a lot.
Right.
And it's certainly one of the go-tos if you've had some form of surgical damage to help.
Right.
If you can get enough blood into the penis that way, but having trouble maintaining the blood flow. And so I think that that is a good option for some men who are having trouble getting the level of erection or the level of firmness that they want out of their erection.
Mm-hmm. And I love, you know, I love to hear the fact, well, I love actually everything that you're saying, because it really aligns with, you know, where I'm at. And again, you know, the cock rings really can make a huge difference, right? If you get the right size and you know how to put them on and you're willing to use them and not feel embarrassed or shame or anything like that.
And cock rings are something that are not talked about a lot. They can be used for purposes of pleasure. They can be used to help maintain the firmness of an erection. It is important to remember that they should not be made out of material that cannot be easily cut off or removed.
But
there's plenty of stretchy silicone cock rings out there. And you're right, you do need to play around a little with the size to get the right one. But when you do, it's also important to remember that this can provide a lot of pleasure for partners.
Right.
Whether your partners are male or female, that the rubbing of the cock ring, if you're having some form of penetration, can be quite pleasurable. And if you're also playing around with your partners in other ways, you can use the cock ring as part of that play.
Exactly. You know, this is just amazing. I'm looking at the time. It is 3:53. I mean, we could talk for another several hours. I want people to know how they can reach you.
Okay. They can reach me through my website, which is psychandsexmd.com. So that's psychandsexmd.com. My email is Dr. Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N. So that's Dr. Gordon, one word, at psychandsexmd.com. I'm also on social media. I am on TikTok and on Instagram, occasionally on Twitter, under the handle at PsychandSexMD. And I do a lot of general public service announcements on sexual health education on social media. That is what I am on there for. And all my contact information is on my website. Other than that.
That's great. Are you seeing patients in person, or is your practice almost like mine, which I actually hate because I miss seeing everybody live? Is most of your practice on Zoom, or are you seeing patients in your office?
So right now I am not seeing patients in the office because 99% of my patients wanted to remain on Zoom.
Right.
I am considering getting the office again, but most people have been preferring Zoom. It's been an easy format for people. Plus, when people are in relationships, it's easy to get everybody there no matter what.
Absolutely right. I joke about this. My practice is on the Upper West Side, and I have people that live a block or two away, and they want to Zoom. I mean, go figure. I mean, really, it's so weird to be seeing people lying down in their beds. They're in their pajamas, and you know, I get like you. I mean, look, if this is the way they want to connect and acknowledge and address and resolve their problems, then so be it. Zoom, and if they want to come in, they want to come in. One last question. Do you accept insurance or not?
I do not accept insurance.
Okay.
I find it very difficult, and I understand that that is a limitation, but I cannot provide the extent of care and the depth of care and the careful considerations that I put into care for people if I were to accept insurance. I do provide super bills so they can submit them, but not accept it.
Right. No, that's exactly the way I work as well. I just want to tell you what a pleasure this is to meet you, and we really need to get together in person.
I would love that.
You're in New York, right?
Yes, I'm in New York. Yeah.
Well, we need to do this. And, you know, the Progressive Radio Network has an archives section. So this whole show has been recorded, and I will send you, or one of my producers will send you the link probably tomorrow.
Great.
And again, I want to thank you. This has been really, really fun and really educational. And I know that people have gotten a lot out of this discussion. And again, I'll definitely be in touch, and we'll have to get together and say hello in person and have a cup of coffee. And again, thank you so very much.
I can't wait. And thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
Yeah, it has been a blast. So take good care, and I'll be in touch very soon, okay?
Great. Thank you again.
Thanks so much, Dr. Gordon. Well, you know, I oftentimes think, you know, who am I going to refer people to here in New York City when it comes to psychiatry and psychiatrists? And I'm so excited that I now have somebody who I actually like and who I embrace your methodologies and your approach. And I want to leave everybody with my two weekly messages. And the first, of course, is that we need to do everything possible to live life in ways that are in our best interest and to find ways to really love ourselves. And of course, secondarily, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in learning to accept and love each other. So goodbye, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in, as you have been for all of these years. And I will talk with you next Monday, and every Monday from 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And have a good rest of the day, and take good care. So goodbye, everybody. Bye. Goodbye.